Welcome to the Gloucester Writers Center. Thanks for coming out tonight. I want to share with you some thoughts about the first speaker tonight, Mark Pavlak. And my first encounter with Mark was in 1988 when I was teaching in East Boston. Oh, geez. Oh, let me start all over again. It's been a long life. All right. When I was teaching at the University of Massachusetts in Boston, and his kindness and friendly ways, as well as his ideas about politics, education, poetry, and world events, helped to make me feel at home at UMass. And then I became familiar with Hanging Loose, one of the oldest and most respected yearly literary magazines. 47 years of publication. Hanging Loose editors published writers such as Sherman Alexie for the first time and subsequently, and Hattie Jones, former wife of Leroy Jones pre-Amira Baraka. And also, Hanging Loose is renowned for publishing high school students from across the country. Mark was a student and lifelong friend of Denise Levertov, and one of the founders of this magazine, and he continues to be co-editor. And Hanging Loose also publishes books, recognizing the necessity of keeping stellar works of poetry and prose in people's hands and on the shelves. In July 2013, Hanging Loose published War Reporter, poems by Dan O'Brien. This is a significant new work on the culture of war. And Alan Shapiro calls this an edgy, heartbreaking amalgam of memoir, dramatic monologue, and poetic intensity. I think I have a copy here if some of you would like to look at. This is the newest work published by Hanging Loose, in which Paul Watson, who was a war reporter, presents his complex personal struggles are seen against the backdrop of political violence. Now we have Mark's recently published an illuminated collection of poems, both formal and informal, and intensely depictive of a small, rural, seacoast place in Maine. And Mark brings the same intense reading of this world as he has to other writings, such as the sharply felt poems that emerge from disturbing news reports and are contained in two of his published books, at least, Special Handling, Newspaper Poems, and Official Versions. Go to the Pine. Quaddy Journals, 2005-2010, is Mark's seventh collection. Influenced by Asian writing, particularly the Haibun of Matsubashu and others, Pollock's impulse to record his astonishment at existence offers the reader a newer, more flexible form of Haibun while reaching for the essence of this form. Marie Harris, formerly Poet Laureate of New Hampshire, writes of this book, "With his eye for the changing light, his ear for the cadences of wave, slap, and foghorn, this is his unsentimental homage to a piece of Maine that's at once achingly beautiful and worn by struggle." Mark's poems have been translated into German, Polish, and Spanish, and it's a great pleasure to introduce Mark Pavlak.
Thank you, Dorothy. That was a lovely introduction. Yeah, we go back a long time. Wonderful colleague at UMass Boston. And thank you, Henry, and the Gloucester Writers Center for inviting me to be here. It's a deep pleasure. I met Vincent Farini in 1979, I think, in Kansas City at the Fool Killers People's Culture Conference. So here I was living in Cambridge, but I had to go all the way to Kansas City to meet Vinny. And subsequently, I visited him here in this house, actually, on several occasions afterwards. And I was happy to be able to attend his 100th commemorative event here in Gloucester earlier this year, and see some of my old friends from that Fool Killer Conference, Fred Whitehead among them, which was really a great treat. for me. So what I wanted to talk about tonight, so I'm going to sort of talk and read, is Dorothy referred to Go to the Pine, my newest book. So I've been working in this form, which I describe as the poetic journal, which has a long history, so I want to talk a little bit about that. And it's a form that, so if I think of this as my kind of pastoral version of the poetic journal, I've simultaneously been working on an urban version since, as Dorothy referred, I teach at UMass Boston. I live in Cambridge, and so I take a bus and the Red Line to work every day. And I've been writing sort of journalistic, observational poems on my travels to and from work as a commuter. Often early in the morning, I take a bus to Harvard Square, and then I go sit in a cafe and write for a little while, and then I get on the Red Line and go to UMass Boston. And I'm usually there at the hour when most of the homeless people in Harvard Square are just beginning to stir. So they've sort of become a subject of some of these poems, as well as just people I encounter and observe and overhear on the bus or on the subway. And then as I continue to sort of explore this form, I actually have a whole new series of poems that are kind of, I was just thinking of Baraka's Lokus. These are sort of my interpretation of some, you know, it's a four line, which is as close as I could get to a haiku, poems that I call natural histories, which are kind of my urban pastoral poems based on sitting in my backyard and observing insects and birds and cats and other creatures of the world, that we share the world with. So I think I'll read a little sampling of all three of those kinds of poems tonight. And as I do, I'll talk a little more about this form, which I'm very interested. I feel like I haven't exhausted, and I'm continuing to explore. So as Dorothy mentioned, the poetic journal in Japanese literature is a very prominent form, poetic diaries, poetic journals, going back to the 11th century. The pillow book was kind of a combination of prose and poetry, written by Sei Shonagon, and then Basho certainly created and kind of perfected this form that we think of as the haibun, which is a kind of combination of prose and poetic epiphanies in the form of haikus. And in fact, Sid Corman did a lovely translation of the Narrow Road to the Interior. It's got very different translators interpret the title slightly differently. Some call it the Narrow Road to the Interior. Some call it the Narrow Road to the North. In any case, it's this it's kind of a travel journal that he perfected. This great haiku poet, in which there are these observational prose passages followed by, or interjected between haiku poems, and that's sort of a form that I began to explore while Mary and I and our son were vacationing summers on the coast of Maine. And I began to record these sort of observations of people and objects, the natural scenery, and interject them with kind of these poetic epiphanies. I think that the American precedents for this form go back to really William Carlos Williams. Experimental books of his that had very little circulation, The Descent of Winter and Spring and All, were really incredibly important books, and were circulated in editions of like 300 at the time of their publication in the teens and the 20s. But when they were republished, were a resource for poets of the generation of Creeley and Kerouac and the sort of the people we think of as the New American Poets. And then, the Beats also were very interested. Many of them were practicing Buddhists and exploring Buddhism. And so the traditions of the Japanese haibun and haiku really kind of found its way into American poetry through those writers. So Kerouac certainly, Gary Snyder, Philip Whalen particularly, and Joanne Kiger, really practiced this kind of poetic journal. I see those sources there. But if you think of the New American Poetry Anthology, where poets were kind of grouped into schools, even though many of them resisted the identification, a lot of poets, Creeley certainly explored the form in his day books, and Levertov did in her political journal that she wrote in the late 60s, early 70s. Paul Blackburn, his very final book was called Journals, and in fact they're poetic journals. And so this was a form that really really found a home here, I think, in American writing. And so, so it's been very inspiring to me. I was very pleased to encounter two young poets who came out of the Naropa program in Boulder, Colorado, who put together a wonderful anthology called, it just went out of my head, it'll come back to me, but it's an anthology that was published maybe 5 or 6 years ago, in which they really collected contemporary exemplars of the poetic journal form. For the Time Being is the title, and it was published by a small press in Lowell, Massachusetts. And that press then ended up publishing this book because those two editors created an imprint for Bootstrap Press, which was called Plain Air Editions. And so they put out one book a year of poetic journals. So I was very pleased to have them select this book of mine to be part of that series. So I think enough about the poetic journal, and I'll start to read some poems and give some samples and say some more about it. So I think I'll start with my urban poems, my commuter poems, and then move on to the other some of the other poems. I think the other poets that I find really inspiring and in the same tradition and are kind of transitional from William Carlos Williams to the New American Poets of Creeley generation were the Objectivist poets. Oppen, Charles Reznikoff, who I've been particularly influenced by, and Loreen Nitecker, who is, again, a wonderful poet working in a very, very small form. So I wanted to start by actually reading something from my journal. And I like to distinguish the difference between a writer's notebook, where as you're reading, you collect particularly apt descriptions of poetics, aphorisms, the beginnings of poems, things you observe, things to be later kind of worked up into poems, perhaps, or to into essays. For me, keeping a journal is something that Levertov introduced me to, but not as not as a poetic form itself, but really just as my notebook, kind of to record things that I could then later use in my own poetry. And it's been the source of essays I've written about my poetics, and just sort of a selection of things. And so I recently, last year in my journal, was reading the notebooks of Theodore Rothke, and I was taken by something he said. So there's these little aphorisms he put in his notebook, It's about small poems, which I think really is apt to the kind of work I've been doing in the Poetic Journal. He said, on small poems, a thing may be small, but it need not be a cameo. It may be a cinder in the shoe, or in the mind's eye, or a pain in the neck. By espousing the simple, I do not deny the subtle, the gnomic rather than the sententious. And then he added, how wonderful to write with a small pen, the recovery of precision. And finally, it is hard to be both plain and direct and not appear a fool to contemporaries fed on illusions, sibylline coziness, hints and shadows. So I think those remarks sort of reflect my work in these sort of small poems and poetic diaries. So I'll start with one series of poems and a poem that kind of in three parts called Apologies to Rilke. And the epigraph is the famous line from his Archaic Torso of Apollo. Du musst dein Leben ändern. You must change your life. The final line of that poem. So this is in three parts. One, 5 a.m. dark. Ruckus of house sparrows, nesting in bedroom air conditioners, tinkle of porch chimes, kitchen fridge hum, toilet flush, water coursing through pipes, gurgle and burp of the coffee maker, heels clacking against hardwood floor downstairs, distant church bells gong. Distract, but only momentarily, from the mice gnawing in my mind's attic. Ich muss mein Leben ändern. 2. Tea station. Boss, one metro hawker is saying to another, as I hurry past to catch my train, boss? I ain't got no boss. I got supervisors. I got supervisors. I ain't got no boss. 3. Red line inbound. Eyes wander to banner ads pasted above windows across the aisle. One in bold lettering inquires, do you worry a lot? Yes, I admit, I do. Feel nervous most of the time? Uh-huh. Feel anxious in social or performance situations? That's me. Have distress, flashbacks, or nightmares from trauma? Not from trauma. Are you anxious? Bingo. Call 866-WORRY. Ich muss mein Leben ändern. And then this is a little sequence called Calendar Pages. January. Banked snow, waist high at subway entrance, now roomy and shrinking in January thaw to reveal the chrome handlebars and green painted frame of this entombed bicycle stenciled in black letters, 15 speeds. March. Blue Chevy pickup parked on bare asphalt with yellow plow fixed to its prow, facing a mound of snow once pristine but now melt-pocked, soot-stained, and topped with a crude wooden sign that's someone hand-lettered in good humor, free snow. May. Along the granite lintel of a second-story window, in the brick wall of a schoolhouse facing train tracks, some child has scrawled with black paint, Messiah coming soon. Sort of observations. Let me do one more of these. It's a bit longer poem. Mm-hmm. This one's titled Faith, Hope, Charity, in no particular order. Street corner morning, sidewalk littered, plastic soda bottles, candy wrappers, aluminum cans. Flotsam after yesterday's snowmelt. When the light's red, a man, paper cup in hand, winter coat unbuttoned, steps off the curb into the sunlit lane between stopped cars. Cradled in the crook of his arm, an improvised sign. Seeking human kindness. All major credit cards accepted. Inside the coffee shop, a line of patrons stretching from counter to threshold, waiting for pastries and morning java. Just outside, three anxious sparrows twittering beneath the bench where a young man sleeps, stretched out, duffel bag for a pillow, face turned away from us passers-by. Beside him, some Samaritan has left a lunch sandwich neatly wrapped in clear plastic, homemade. I descend into the subway station. The ever-cheerful Metro hawker greets me. Have a nice day. At the Dunkin' Donuts kiosk, a dark-skinned man, West Indian, curly gray hair under the knit cap he wears in all seasons, cargo bags at his feet, hunches over an open Bible, pedestal table his lectern. Some days he scribbles in a notebook. Sermons? Other times, lips moving, eyes turned inward, he recites passages to himself. Today, he lifts his head, casts his gaze over the multitude, hand extended, and citing chapter and verse, silently preaches to his congregation, entering, exiting through the turnstiles, all of us sinners and no one in particular. So those are some of the sort of subway commuter poems that I've been working on. So now let me turn to some of the main poems. And usually when I... So this book is structured. There's really four journals here, four different years, four different summers. And I usually skip around, but I thought tonight I would like to just read a sequence from one summer, sort of the sequential passage of it. Each of them is preceded by a piece called A Bold Coast Partita. A Bold Coast, these poems are centered in Lubeck, Maine, so way up the coast, right at the Canadian border. And that area of the Atlantic coast is there known as the Bold Coast. So this piece is called The Bold Coast Partita Saraband. A fast and erotic or slow triple time movement. Tire collars around wharf posts, tall sea damp wooden poles, weed draped netting, frayed rope hank, wrist thick yellow nylon braids, sun bleached wood plinth, axe head nicked, auger dulled, jerry can dented, chain link cracked. Beach dragger, half submerged, listing with each lapping wave. Winch, spooled cable, boom, all rust crusted. Dulse, bladder rack, pom pom, purple laver, barnacle, whelk, limpet, periwinkle. Bivalves in mesh bags, mussels steamed in white wine, glazed stoneware bowls. So that's sort of the introduction. So this poem is titled Reveille. Sun at two ticks above horizon, air crystalline, with just a hint of heat haze to come. not a breath of wind to stir the leaves of trees and bushes, marsh grasses, roadside weeds, garden flowers. Rill of a red-winged blackbird tests the silence. A baying hound follows suit. Fool, its scolding neighbor barks back, that ain't no moon. A pickup truck passes, wiping the slate clean. Start again from scratch. Sun now at 3 ticks. Crow has something to say about it. Another barking dog finishes the thought. More tires kissing tarmac. Far off, a 10-wheeler testing its brakes. Now a great blue heron parachutes to marsh pool mudflat, folds its wings, strikes a serious pose. Time to get to work. Hear lowing Herefords answer the channel foghorn. Hummingbirds probe white hydrangeas. Crows hector other crows while harrowers harvest salt hay. Hard hats and pickups haul ass up gravel lanes, and hardy hikers traverse cliffside trails at Quoddy Head. Paradise. Rusted tractor, lobster boat up on blocks, tall weeds grown up around them. Parked on either side of the garage at the corner of this gravel lane leading to the marsh. The lobster boat badly in need of paint. Paint on the garage walls weathered too. Wood grain and knots showing through. But windows still intact. Stencil sign on the door reads, Car Wash, 50 cents. 50 cents crossed out. 25 cents scrawled below. This, the street sign says, this is Paradise Lane. Sign in the window of the mobile gas and convenience store announces in bold letters, free ride in sheriff's car. Adding in small print at the bottom, if you are caught shoplifting in this store. Lunch break. Uncle Kippy's seafood and takeout. Stop in. Otherwise, we'll both go hungry. IGA. Two men in pickups parked side by side in the IGA lot, jawing out their driver's side windows. One, smiling, asks the other in a heavy Down East accent, been in the ditch again lately? Let me finish this reading from this. How am I doing for time, Dorothy? Are you keeping track? Okay. So this piece, this is the final poem in this book called Adieu. It's a long one, so. Adieu. Goodbye, gray smudge of headland masking the horizon. So long, thin chalk line of fog drawn along its margin. Auf Wiedersehen, slate blue sea marked with imperfect erasures. Sayonara, moss thatch, skull caps atop granite outcroppings. Au revoir, dripping firs whose needles tickle moisture from wind-blown mist and sea spray. Ta-ta, boggy riprap trails meandering along cliff edges, surf pounding below. Dovidzinha, white-knuckled tree roots gripping rock fissures against onslaughts of wind, rain, and gale-tossed waves. Shalom, stand of sun-bleached, wind-burnished, silver-white tree trunks impersonating wrathful Tibetan deities. Ciao, chorus lines of roadside grasses whose shaggy hangdong heads on long slender necks nod and sway in unison. Bis später, silver and white birches trading gossip and stage whispers about the prickly pines. Fins aviat, purple verging on pink fireweed standing in pools of brackish water. Abientot, discarded beer cans flattened on road shoulders where truck tires have left their impression. Adios mowers, chippers, bush hoggers, weed whackers, advertising services on sandwich boards lining the highway. Hasta luego, tree fellers, clam diggers, purse seiners, oyster shuckers. Salam, shrub trees and bushes whose leaves turn giddy with every breeze. Salud, wind whistling through wires strung between utility poles. Salakale, scudding billows above white-capped sea swells. Cheerio, channel ferries straining to make headway against fundy tides. Arrivederci, white-clapboard houses on shorelines dazzling in early morning light. So long, intermittent foghorn, clanking channel boy. So long, farewell, auf Wiedersehen, goodbye, adieu, adieu to you and you and you. Stop there.
So wonderful to hear the writer read, and I'll go back, and it'll even be more enlivened for me to go back and look at these beautiful poems.
Yeah, I think that's always the case. You know, I mean, one of the poets that I always struggled with Pound's Cantos until I heard recordings of him read them, and it just sort of opened them up for me. You know. I think partly because of the sort of, you know, the kind of paratactic and collage structure of them, it was hard to, you know, to follow the so-called narrative of the poems. But hearing him, then suddenly I got it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so yeah, I think it's always.
So where's Tanusha? Is she?
Yeah,
here. Oh, there you are. I was just thinking about. I still think about Norwood when he said, "You say my poetry is obscure, you know, and have faith, just, you know." And we talked about that because he has other aspects to his work too, Norbert is, besides that. But I'm so pleased you're here, Danusha. Danusha has a wonderful book of poems of Norbert that she's translated that would be good to sit around, and maybe we could read that and then have you read to us. I think it would be great sometime. I want to introduce Mary Bonina, who's going to read to us from her new book, Down My Father's Eyes. And what is remarkable about Mary Bonina's new memoir, My Father's Eyes, is a depiction of a young child determined to help her father see the world around him as his ability to see slowly declines and eventually disappears. The child makes a commitment to her father. She will see for him. But she is young enough not to be concerned with her own take on things. She will see things as they are, the world that he needs to be able to see, based on her understanding of his requirements. This is an extraordinary act of the imagination, one that has been lost overall to humanity, which has made a mockery of the word maturity. This is one reason that I use the word, the Greek word heuristic, in talking about Mary's memoir. All through these pages, the child is asking questions, wondering, and imagining. Her achievements result from this inquiring approach. Not knowing the answers, not knowing what was meant in overheard conversations, not knowing the motivations of others, these unknowns do not stymie her. Instead, they allow her to continue to inquire, carving her way as she goes along towards knowledge and possibilities. The young Mary Bonina is seeing the world through her father's eyes, and we are seeing all of this through Mary Bonina's eyes. Let's see where I am here. A vision that is unrelenting in the quest for discovery by means of practice and inquiry. I think one of the great qualities of this book is the way it allows and invites the reader to go through Mary's experience, thus igniting our own imagination. Here is the connection, one connection, between memoir, fiction, and literary art. Mary Bonina is a recipient of numerous grants, awards, and recognition for her writing. The Teacher's Voice, a journal for poets and writers in education, named her finalist for Lunch in Chinatown, poems inspired by the experience of teaching English to immigrants in their workplaces. She was winner of Boston Contemporary Authors Competition for her poem Drift, now a permanent public art installation in Boston, located outside the Orange Line at the Green Street Station in Jamaica Plain. And she has been a fellow for many years at the Virginia Center for the Creative Arts. Her poems have appeared in journals and anthologies, and it's with great pleasure that I introduce you to Mary Bonina.
Well, I've been trying to figure out what I will read for what audiences. It's always an interesting process that I go through. When I read from this in Worcester, where I grew up, I wanted to have some passages that specifically referred to the city of Worcester. But also, I wanted to be able to give people a sense of how the book is structured, how there are so many different time periods in the book, and there's the historical context of the 1950s and the 1960s especially, but then there are later chapters that alternate with the childhood chapters that happen a few decades later, but also fill in what's gone on with my father, with me, with the family, seen through the lens of the week my father died in the 1990s, 1993. So these chapters alternate in much the same way that a novel will use different time periods. They'll have kind of like plots that keep enriching each other and going back and forth. So that happens in this book. So what I want to do is read some sections from each of those. And I thought I wanted to convey what Dorothy was referring to, my perception as a child trying to understand what's happening. Because in the 1950s, parents did not take their children aside or, you know, send them to therapy to understand, you know, the fact that their father was going blind or, you know, there anything was happening. People would, you know, die in front of you and that would be it, you know. There was absolutely no explanation. And so none of this was talked about, and as Dorothy, referred to it, I was eavesdropping a lot and trying to, and my imagination was just going wild. And so I want to read a chapter to start with called Barricade, which happens in 1956. I was 6 years old in 1956. And this takes place the fall after the spring in which my father has driven a car for the last time. I should say he has just been diagnosed with a condition that affects the retina, which creates a kind of tunneling of the vision. It's the opposite of what we hear about a lot these days, macular degeneration, which is the loss of central vision. This is just the opposite. It's the loss of the peripheral vision, and it's very gradual. So it happens so that, you know, the tunnel keeps getting more narrow all the time. It's, you know, this big circle, and hence the cover, which my stepson wonderfully designed using a photograph that wasn't a very good photograph, but conveying the theme of the book. And you see the circle there and the blurred edges. And so that's, you know, that's what that's what the cover's about. But anyway, so my father has just, he has driven, when the book opens, my father has driven a car for the last time, and I've been in it with him. And he has not been able to see what color the light is at an major intersection, and there's, anyway, that's chapter one. And so that ends in a way that you might expect, with not with an accident, but with my mother laying down the law. There will be no driving the car anymore. He wasn't supposed to be driving the car. So this chapter, Barricade, happens. He is at the time working in a factory as a machinist, a toolmaker. He was a skilled toolmaker. And it was something he continued to do for a good many years after he had very little sight left, even, which is kind of remarkable, to say the least. And he can't drive a car, and he's working the late shift, the 3 to 11 shift, and he's walking home late at night. So this very major loss of independence, the ability to drive a car, to get where you want to go, when you want to go, has been taken away from him. And he's walking the streets late at night when night vision is going. That's one of the first things that goes with this. I've had a cold, so this is going to... I think so. I've had a cold, so I'm going to have some difficulty probably talking, but it's finished, but it's left this. So he has lost the ability to drive. So that's when Barricade happens. I'll wait until I get some water. Thank you. I should have done this before I got up here. Thanks, Anna. Thanks, Chloe. Okay, I have to take off the glasses. Barricade, 1956. After our Sunday joyride in the Packard, when my mother had ordered my father never to go near the car again and then saw to it that it was put up for sale, there were no longer family outings after washing and waxing the Packard. What it meant to my father was that he had to walk to and from his job at the Press Metal Company where he worked the 3 to 11 p.m. shift, often 6 days a week. It was nearly a 2-mile walk each way, requiring him to leave the house earlier in the day, and it meant that he'd get home later at night than he had before when he'd been able to drive the distance. My mother did not know how to drive at the time. When my father turned in his license, so the car stayed idle in the yard until it was finally sold. Everyone except me ignored it. I watched it, as if I had been given the responsibility of guarding it for my father. One morning when I got out of bed and went into the yard to check on it, as I did at various times of the day, I found that the car had disappeared. I had not been told that a sale was imminent. I remember only the fantasy I created about the loss. I had a fantastic imagination. I settled on the idea that the car not only looked like a wild animal, but that it really was one after all, and that it had gone back to its real life as a big cat. I remembered my father always said that the car purred whenever he started it up. I knew from my Aunt Margaret telling me that bears and big cats still roamed the woods of Maine, and I imagined that maybe the car had taken off in that direction. Like most children, I was interested in wild animals and curious about places where men and women rode horses and were free as the breeze. I read books that took place in wide open spaces and mystery stories, too, with my idea of the car transformed into a cat, just like one of the Transformer toys my own son played with when he was younger, and drawing on plots of adventure shows I watched on television on Saturdays back then. I imagined that the car, the cat in its new life, was sneaking up on Penny, and that Sky King would have to rescue her, although it would be dangerous and difficult for him to land his plane in the mountains. I pretended, too, that the car-turned cat was waiting at some mountain pass to pounce on the Lone Ranger and Tonto. I guess I felt sometimes like galloping away myself, so I did so in my imagination. "You kids will be the death of me yet," Mum was always saying. We didn't know what she meant. We wanted to run sometimes. "You'll crack your skulls open and have to get stitches at the hospital emergency room. Can't you find something else to do?" Peg and I skated in our stocking feet on the newly polished wood floors. "You'll get slivers, I'm telling you." We begged her to let us go to Coe's Pond, where we knew other kids went swimming. "No, and I don't want to hear any more about it. Do you want to get polio? Every Tom, Dick, and Harry swims at Coe's Pond. You'll never know what disease you might get." I was bored, and so I sometimes retreated to my hideout, the bedroom. I shared with my sister Peg. I closed the door and sang Home on the Range passionately, the lyrics about being in a place where there hardly was a discouraging word spoken and where there were no cloudy days. Or else I went quietly down the back stairs and out to the yard. When it got to be winter, I wouldn't go out of the house. Instead, I sat inside the hall on the bottom step, as far away as I could get from the upstairs door to our apartment. But when I went out in summer, I used the front entrance and enjoyed the coolness of that big hall, with its oak staircase, vanilla-colored toile wallpaper, decorated with scenes of country ladies in long dresses strolling or sitting under sprawling willow trees near ponds. The front hall was a great place to dream. On the second floor landing, there were three long windows in a bay, and built into the wall in front of them an oak window seat that opened up when you lifted a small brass ring. Inside, I found that there were books, some probably there, my mother said, going back to the time when the house was first occupied. I knew that there was a book called Ben-Hur stored somewhere in the window seat. Driven to search for it, I used to take it out sometimes just to look at it and touch it. The pages of Ben-Hur had gold edging. I would turn the book on its side and feel its smooth golden thickness. I was in awe of what I thought, from the looks of it, must have been an important book. I would find it under large, heavy books with titles like Drafting and Crafting Machine Tools. "Leave those there," my mother said when I wanted to know about them. "Those belong to your father." When I stood on tiptoes near the bottom stairs of the lower landing, I could create a new world by looking in first one, then another, of each stained glass window pane. I loved making our unchanging neighborhood change. Looking through one pane of glass, I saw that it was yellow. In another, it turned blue. I looked in all the other squares of colored glass, and I could make it red, green, or purple. I liked seeing Mr. Sadowski in the yard next door. He looked best yellow. He was a scary-looking old man in the first place, and in yellow he looked more so. I told my sister Peg to try it to see how creepy he looked when he was yellow, and she said, "Stop scaring me." Sometimes I visited Bill Roach, who lived across the street from us in the funny eight-sided house. "A real octagon," he told me. I'd find him sitting in a rocker, reading the newspaper on the front porch, or else he would be out puttering the old, big old barn behind his house. He had a lot of junk in there, lots to do. The place smelled of oil from fixing things and sawdust from his other projects. He was always doing something. He put up a swing just for me, made from a tire's inner tube that hung on a thick rope attached to a hook in the rafters. The swing was right at the front entrance to the barn, and the doors were always wide open. "Hold on now," Bill advised me as he pulled back the rope that held the old Goodyear tire. When he let go, I flew out the barn door, my feet aimed right at my family's house. I closed my eyes and let gravity pull me back into the barn, and Bill pushed me out again. Swinging was relaxing, and so was sitting in one of the rockers on the porch. I liked my conversations with Bill wherever they happened. Bill had a wife named Mary, like me, like my mother, and I often wondered how many Marys there were in the world anyway. Sometimes he told me to go into the house and say hello to his wife, and he knew that someone had, because he knew that someone had just given her a box of Schraff's chocolates and that she might be willing to share them. If I couldn't decide which one to take from the assortment I was offered, Mary told me the pinching one until it bled its strawberry or orange cream was allowed. When I was at home and When I was at home and tried her technique of deciding which chocolate to choose, it gave my mother yet another reason to yell, "Where did you learn to do that?" she wanted to know. And when I told her, she said, "Hasn't Mary Roach ever heard of germs? Don't let me see you do that again." I knew the streets my father had to walk late at night after he didn't drive anymore. I had heard my mother say that he ought to ask someone to give him a ride home from work. If he didn't want to do that, she thought that at the very least he shouldn't take the Beacon Street route. Forget Beacon, walk up to Main. At least it's got street lighting and cars go by, even at that hour. Although parallel to Main Street, Beacon was much darker. A large part of the street, the stretch my father walked near midnight, was lined with brick factory buildings, creating a tunnel effect. Did the industrialists, with their particular brand of 19th century optimism, give the street such a bright and promising name as Beacon? Perhaps my father was afraid that his eyes might play tricks on him, and that is the reason he did not walk the other way. What I know now about the progress of his shrinking vision is that all the different varieties of lighting on the Main Street route would have been jarring to him. He would have had trouble adjusting his eyes to competing neon signs and the headlights of passing cars, while also accommodating the regular pattern of streetlights broken by intervals of darkness on the outer reaches of the business district. I am spending a lot of time sorting out fact from fiction. That is the hardest part of what I'm trying to do. I have found that once I get people and events straight in terms of time, the pieces almost write themselves. For example, I spent one day thinking, trying to sort out the truth of my memory of the night when I found that, coming in from work near midnight, my father had barricaded the kitchen door to the back hallway. My memory was sketchy. My mother wasn't present in it for some reason, and that perplexed me. I knew that I was very young, and I also believed that this event had happened soon after the last ride I'd had with my father in the Packard, which I'm fairly certain took place in late spring of 1956. Not only did I remember that my mother was not involved that night I want to describe, but I also remembered that she was in the hospital for some reason. She was hospitalized often while I was growing up, as it seemed so many women were in those years, for surgeries, or she'd get pneumonia or let some minor infection get out of hand. I realized, though, that those health problems came later than 1956. That led me to these questions. Who then was taking care of us if my mother was not there? And if she was in the hospital, what was the reason? I was the oldest. I celebrated my 6th birthday on November 2, 1956. Peg was a year and 9 months younger, and Kate that much younger than Peg. Someone had to dress us, take us to school, give us breakfast, lunch, and supper, and bathe us before putting us to bed at night. Who? Once I could answer that question, I was then able to determine that, yes, my mother was in hospital, in fact, and more importantly, I knew why. Was it Auntie Margaret watching over us? My mother's sister was, I thought, the one most likely to have been taking care of us at night in my mother's absence. In my childhood memories, she's always there. My meditation led me to a series of associations by which I was then able to determine that it was not my Aunt Margaret taking care of us, but rather my Aunt Jean, my father's youngest sister, who was just a teenager then. She would not have seen what my father did, barricaded the door when he came home, because she was tired out from taking care of us and went to bed early, when we children did. Because she lived out of town, she was staying with us, not just babysitting for the evening. "I sleep like the dead," she said to me when I asked her all these years later if she could remember anything about that night. She knew something had happened, but her memory was vague. Still, I knew it was my Aunt Jean staying with us once I recalled having had a conversation with her on Ripley Street, just outside the building where my first grade class was located. We were walking home. She'd come to meet me at school. I was in the first grade in 1956. The first graders were the youngest children at St. Peter's, and the lower grades were, at that time, set apart from the others in an old wood-frame farmhouse just up the street from the main building. Aunt Jean was walking me home from school. We were on the sidewalk there. To my amazement, in my memory of us talking, I could even visualize the direction we were facing on the street. I remembered snippets of our conversation. The subject was memorable because I had asked my aunt if there really was a Santa Claus, and that question is surely a milestone in a child's life. I was brought to the topic because I was no doubt thinking that Halloween was coming soon. I suppose that I may have associated then that my birthday was right after it in November, which meant that Christmas was not far away. It was that time of year when there was one childhood occasion after another. Aunt Jean, being so young, was more like an older friend than an adult, and I thought she might tell me the truth about Santa, and she did. That is how I dated this event. My mother had gone to the hospital to deliver my brother Jack, who was born on October 27th, the year I turned 6. That night, I discovered the barricade. I was startled awake and wondering about the unfamiliar noise keeping me from dozing off again. It was not one of the sounds I generally heard in the house late at night, when it was extremely quiet, the whirring of the refrigerator, the muffled footsteps of the upstairs tenants, or the pipes knocking when someone in the downstairs apartment ran the water. This was different, and I didn't know what it was. Not having a clock in my bedroom, I didn't know the time, only that it was still dark when I decided to get out of bed to investigate. According to the clock on the wall in the dining room, it was midnight. Perhaps what I had heard was only my father coming in late from work. Because he walked home, the factory not being on any bus route and buses in our city not running that late at night anyway, he didn't usually get home until midnight. I knew that my father never asked anyone to give him a ride home. I had heard my mother telling him over and over again that he should. I could see a light on in the bathroom and a shadow in the frosted glass window of the door. Water was running in the sink. I went into the kitchen, and that is when I found out what the noise was all about. I saw the barricade, the table, formica topped, and with curved metal legs, like the chairs that went with it, had been moved, dragged across the linoleum floor from the middle of the room and put in front of the door to the back hall. The chairs, too, were there, standing not on the floor, but on top of the table, the way that my father stacked them in pairs when he was going to wash the kitchen floor. They were stacked seat to seat, one placed upside down in the lap of the other, but it was after midnight, too late to be washing the floor. The three sets of chairs on top of the table looked like they were waiting to have guards seated in them. On the stovetop counter there was a pack of Lucky Strikes, and I knew that meant my father was home. So I went to the bathroom door and called to him. "Dad?" "Dad," he answered. When he came to the door, he was drying his chin with a towel. He must have just come home. He was still wearing the army green-colored shirt and pants, his work clothes. "What are you doing out of bed?" he asked. "I have to pee," I pretended. He came out of the bathroom and I went in, closing the door behind me. I did not really have to pee, so I waited a minute, then flushed the toilet and ran water in the sink, while counting to 60 before coming out. In the kitchen, I saw my father standing, staring at the back door. He seemed to be looking past the table and chairs, past the door even, and into the hallway outside. He didn't look like he was seeing anything, but he was listening hard, I could tell, for someone, something. He held his head still, as if tuning into some very small sound, little as the click of a key in the lock. A noise woke me up. I didn't know what it was, I said, hoping for an explanation. "Just me, probably," he confirmed. "Don't worry." He said no more, so I had to ask. "Why did you move the table, and why are the chairs on top of it?" "The lock on the door is broken," he answered. "Someone will come in the morning. The chairs and table are there, just to be safe." "I missed you, Dad." My father looked the way I suppose I do when I'm scared and pretending not to be. Although he told me that night that everything was all white, I worried. I wondered if he was frightened because he thought that someone had followed him home, tracking him along the midnight streets. I had heard him saying to my mother not long before that when he was walking home, he thought sometimes that he could hear footsteps behind him. My mother said that he was imagining things, that he was afraid of his own shadow. What if there really had been some person, someone who wanted to rob him, some burglar who would try to get into our house in the night while we were sleeping? Or what if there was someone who wanted to hurt my father? Would his barricade help keep out such trouble? These were thoughts I had that night when I saw what my father had done and how he was acting. Before leaving the kitchen to go back to bed, I stopped at the window above the yard. I looked out, but I didn't see anything moving outside, just the branches of the trees swaying in the gentle wind and something rolling around in the gutter, maybe a paper Dixie cup or the cardboard roll left from a rocket push-up ice cream treat. The floodlights were always on at the furniture store in the corner, and one could see clear to Main Street. I don't see anyone outside, Dad, not a person, a car, or anything out there. I remember that when I looked back at him, he was still standing, listening near the door. We're safe, I said. He smiled. Now you really should go back to bed. I'm going, I said. We all had our fingers crossed that when my mother came home from the hospital, she would bring back a baby boy. Did my father send me to bed that night, telling me to say my prayers before I went to sleep? I said goodnight to my father and went to my station behind the slightly open bedroom door. There I sat, in my usual snooping spot, where I would often fall asleep while eavesdropping and would be discovered there and have to be carried into bed. On this night, though, I stayed awake, waiting in the dark until the house was quiet. When I was sure that my father had gone to bed, almost certain that he would be asleep, I got up and went silently to the front bedroom. I stood there like a statue, not even breathing, at the foot of the bed to check on him. Once I was sure that he was asleep, I went back out into the kitchen, knowing that sleep would not come for me until I had checked the lock on the back door. I didn't believe what my father had said, that the lock was broken, and that was the reason for his barricade. I knew my Aunt Jean had locked the door earlier. I'd watched her lock it after Peg and Kate and I came in for supper after playing out in the yard all afternoon. I remembered I'd asked her why she was locking the door. I told her that our mother never locked the door when we were at home, only when we were going out. Aunt Jean wouldn't unlock it, though. This is the city, she said. People need to lock their doors in the city. Aunt Jean lived in Milford. It was a small town. It was like the country where she lived. The room was full of moonlight, enough for me to see, so I crawled under the table to get to the lock. I reached up and slid the bolt over, then turned the knob to see if the door was locked. It was, just as I had thought. I wondered then why my father hadn't told me the truth about his reason for barricading the door. I wondered if someone really had been following him, or if he had just been imagining things like my mother said. Like my mother said I did whenever I was scared of the dark and I thought I heard someone in my room. Even with the barricade, I did not feel safe. I went to bed, but I was frightened, and I wanted to know what secret my father was keeping from me. Next to the bed, I slept in with my sister Peg, who had not stirred. There was a chest of drawers. I kept a photograph in there of my mother and father. It was one that I had secretly slipped out of a family album at Grammy's house. I had hidden it for those times when I was scared and confused. There was not enough light over at the window. The moon had moved, and I could see that it was shining brightly on the aluminum roof of the garage next door. I knew that I might wake Peg, but it was the chance I took, putting on the light just long enough to take a look, knowing that seeing the photograph would help me get back to sleep. I gave Mom and Dad in the picture a kiss goodnight. The year 1947 is stamped on the back of the scallop-edged snapshot that I still have, taken before they were married, before they became my mother and father. They are standing outside the house I recognized as my Aunt Margaret's summer cottage in Maine, standing in front of the porch in the patchy dry grass. The Packard is there in the background. I had had my own picture taken in that same spot. Whoever the photographer was didn't pay any attention to the sun. In the picture, my father squints, looking pale and not like the dark-skinned man I knew. My mother smiles just like she is in some advertisement for toothpaste in one of the ladies' magazines she used to read. She does not look even a little camera shy. Excuse me. Her blonde hair is very light, lighter than it really was when she was young, almost white, the way it is now in her 10th decade. I can tell from this picture that they were in love, just by looking at the way they were holding on to each other. My father had his right arm around her shoulder and his hand on his upper arm. As I'm so sorry. As if he is protecting her. Her arm is looped around behind him at the waist, and I can see one of my mother's small hands on my father's hip. They are a good-looking couple. That night, my father barricaded the door, and I had discovered his fear, and mine too. I shut off the light after looking at the photograph. I crawled into bed and closed my eyes. I could still see the picture in my mind of my mother and father together, and soon I fell asleep. So that's 1956. And let's see what time it is. I don't know. Am I going on too long? I have that short piece that you heard at the bookstore, The Train Ride. Should I read that?
Yeah.
What do people think?
How
okay.
Are you doing?
I'm going to drink some more water before I start anymore.
I think
because the heat's on, it's like made my throat dry, because I was fine all day. This is amazing. That might be. Well, no. Don't. I think this is okay. The next piece is much shorter and easier to read. And it takes place in 1993, the week my father died. And it gives you a sense of what he's been up to. He had by then, he became a businessman after he lost his sight. He went to a rehab program in Newton. At the time, it's now called the Carroll School for the Blind or the Carroll Center for the Blind. At the time, it was called St. Paul's Rehabilitation Center for Newly Blinded Adults. And he had always had entrepreneurial leanings. He had been like the force behind my parents buying a house, two houses that had rental apartments in them, which is sort of how we survived while he was making this transition from, you know, the work that he had been doing to becoming a businessman. You'll see many of his characteristics. His stubbornness, which I think, you know, served him well. I mean, he was able to do amazing things in his life, and this book is about him as much as it's about me. But, you know, his stubbornness and his risk-taking, all of these things, he, you know, if he was going to do what he did, he had to be this way. But he was also infuriating at times for some of the things he did, which which you'll see, I think, in this. And this takes place on the day that I'm going to Mass General Hospital to collect his personal effects, and it's a flashback that takes place in that chapter. Okay, and it, as I said, it's much shorter than that piece. It was 1990. Oh, actually, this is 1990. This is the flashback from 1993. Yeah, it was 1990, and at the time, I was teaching at New England Medical Center in Boston. At Washington Street Station, downtown crossing, I had to change from the orange to the red line, and as it turned out that day, I boarded the same car of the same train my father was on, returning to the Cambridge Y from his cafeteria. I knew the train was coming into the station by the difference I heard in sound as the conductor began to brake. I knew it was time to get off, registering it unconsciously, and I stood up. Oh, no, wait, hold on a second. Oh, yeah, that's right. Okay, sorry, I thought I went to the back at the end of this. Okay. I knew the train was coming into the station by the difference I heard in sound as the conductor began to brake. I knew it was time to get off, registering it unconsciously, and I stood up. I was the first in our car on my feet heading to the door, even though the train was still in the tunnel. Then I was first off the train, meeting the 5 o'clock rush hour crowd head-on, pushing my way past the knot of old people, school kids, and suits who edged up to the door to enter the train. I hustled, weaving in and out and around people to get to the stairway leading to the lower platform to make my red line connection. I flew down the stairs, jumping the last two. I avoided the obstacle course of musicians and their instrument cases full of spare change and recordings for sale. The stairway ended at the open first car of the train. I saw the conductor sticking his head out of his compartment, ready to close the door, and I was in before he did on my way to Central Square. When I looked up, I saw my father. He was standing right in front of me, the last person I would have expected to meet by chance. What were the odds of it? He spooked me. "Well, hello," I said. Of course he knew my voice. "Ree," he smiled as if he had been expecting me. He was coming from work that evening on the train headed over the Charles River on Longfellow Bridge from Boston into Cambridge, being at the time the operator of the Harbor Mist Cafeteria, which served the U.S. Coast Guard headquarters building on the Northern Avenue waterfront. Those who worked there and in other waterfront businesses, salesmen making their rounds and mail carriers, occasionally tourists as well, ate breakfast and lunch or had coffee or snack at my dad's cafeteria. Calling it that name, Harbor Mist, was his idea. For the fact of its location and the sometimes damp and foggy coastal weather, and of course for the fact of his own blindness. When I'd call him on the phone there, he would answer, "Harbor Mist, pea soup here." "There's a seat behind you. Why don't you sit?" I said, when the train gave a jolt. I suspected I was not the first person to have offered him a seat since he'd boarded one stop before at South Station. Realizing that he was blind, seeing his cane, people were generally willing to give up their seats on a rush hour train, but he politely declined. "I'm fine. I'll stand. You sit." "No, I don't want to sit. You sit," he said, resisting my offer as well. "No, that's okay. I'm fine." I would have loved to sit, but I wanted to talk to him more than I wanted to sit, and if I sat down, it would have separated us. He was happy when we talked, and I enjoyed talking with him as well. I was tired after teaching, but I wasn't on my way home yet. I was going to my night job. I was hungry. I was pregnant. But I knew that my father had awakened at 4 a.m., and I knew he rarely sat down all day. He was not in the best of health and was nearly 30 years older than I was. But he looked well, strong, and you'd think healthy, though a little tired. He wasn't going home to Worcester to a good dinner, a wife, and a comfortable home until the weekend. He was headed to a room at the Cambridge Y, his home during the work week. My mother didn't want to move. "Where did you get those duds?" I teased him. I was talking too loudly. A very proper-looking woman gave me the eye. I was insulting a blind man, she thought, probably. She knew he was blind because he was carrying a scratched and dented metal cane, which he held like a shepherd's staff. "What do you mean?" my father asked, his eyes feigning innocence. "What you're wearing," I said, losing patience. "What do you mean, what I'm wearing?" He looked defiant then, rather than perplexed. He knew full well what was wrong with what he was wearing. It was the costume he had on, a disguise. What people saw of my father on a rush hour train was the way he survived in the big city. He looked as if he were wearing clothes that came straight out of the laundry bag, unironed clothes. His charcoal gray pants were some kind of wool and synthetic blend, and their rough surface gave the impression that the slacks had been washed instead of dry cleaned. "You have good clothes," I said. "What are you doing dressing like this in public? Do you know what I paid for these pants when I bought them?" "These pants are from Shacks," he said, referring to a men's clothing store in Worcester. "And this is an Arrow shirt I've got on," he smirked. "They've seen better days," I said. The people sitting along the train bench facing us looked uncomfortable. I could tell they were, as they looked up at us, hovering above them and talking. Hearing our conversation, they resettled themselves in their seats after exchanging glances and raised eyebrows. They didn't know he was my father. What did they think? They saw me as a professional, I suppose. I could have been a lawyer dressed as I was. Nice suit, good shoes, coach bag. My brother Jack once told me that I looked like I worked for IBM when he met me for dinner one day after work. I was a writer then, too, but I had a day job as a corporate trainer, one who taught English to medical and bank employees. I had a night job, too, creating a program to help adults learn to read and write, and I was headed there on that train. I watched the other passengers watching my father and me. I had watched people watch us my whole life. Seeing us on the train together that evening, did they think that I was a lawyer harassing a homeless blind man? "So what have you got in the bag anyway?" I asked, quieter and more politely. My father had the brown, wrinkled, and crumpled shopping bag rolled up and tucked under his arm. I knew what was in the bag, although no one on the train would have guessed. I was provoking him, a low blow, I know. I knew. He was secretly afraid that someone would find out that the bag was stuffed with cash. I hadn't meant to scare him. I just wanted him to stop taking this risk. That is why I confronted him. Still, that he carried that money that way, in this day and age, as my mother would have said, was comical. And he knew it. We shared the joke. "My snacks," he said, smiling impishly. "Peggy Lawton's." He was referring to the brownies he sold at his cafeteria. He wanted everyone on the train to think that it was lunch he had in the bag. He was carting the cash proceeds from his restaurant, his day's earnings, back and forth on the train, and on Fridays he took the whole week's receipts home, stuffed in his suitcase on the Peter Pan bus from Boston to Worcester. He would have rather been a hero, lose his money being robbed at gunpoint, than have had to pay someone to make bank deposits and still have to worry about whether he was being taken advantage of or not. He didn't have time to go to the bank himself, he said, so he carried a big lunch instead. My father's concern with money wasn't greed. The only fear he seemed to have kept alive all the years from the time he was certain that he was losing his sight some 40 years before was the worry that he wouldn't be able to provide for the care of his family and his own simple needs. He wanted next to nothing for himself, good, comfortable shoes, a Sunday suit with clean shirts, and an occasional meal at a nice restaurant to celebrate a family event or a birthday. And if going in disguise, looking destitute, was what he had to do to make sure he had those things, so be it. He put his pride in his pocket, he said. It was his little joke on the world of the sighted. My father and I were the first to move toward the door as the train approached Central Square Station. We had both heard it, the change in sound, registering it unconsciously and automatically, as always. Neither of us needed to see where we were. We simply reached out and grabbed the metal pole just as we were about to feel the jolt as the train braked. We knew it signaled our arrival. We knew where we were at all times. My father gently took my arm, his left hand on my right elbow, like a key that moved me forward, propelled us both up the stairs and outside to the street. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.